be proceeded on, or where they are," rejoined Traddles, opening his eyes. "And I anticipate that between this time and his departure, Mr. Micawber will be constantly arrested or taken in execution." "Then he must be constantly set free again and taken out of execution," said my aunt. "What's the amount altogether?" "Why, Mr. Micawber has entered the transactions. He calls them transactions with great form in a book," rejoined Traddles, smiling, "and he makes the amount £103.05. Now, what shall we give him that sum included?" said my aunt. "Agnes, my dear, you and I can talk about division of it afterwards. What should it be, £500? Upon this, Traddles and I both struck in at once. We both recommended a small sum in money, and the payment, without stipulation, to Mr. Micawber of the Uriah claims as they came in. We proposed that the family should have their passage and their outfit and £100, and that Mr. Micawber's arrangement for the repayment of the advances should be gravely entered into, as it might be wholesome for him to suppose himself under that responsibility. To this I added the suggestion that I should give some explanation of his character and history to Mr. Peggotty, who I knew could be relied on, and that to Mr. Peggotty should be quietly entrusted the discretion of advancing another £100. I further proposed to interest Mr. Micawber in Mr. Peggotty, by confiding so much of Mr. Peggotty's story to him as I might feel justified in relating or might think expedient, and to endeavour to bring each of them to bear upon the other for the common advantage. We all entered warmly into these views, and I may mention at once that the principals themselves did so shortly afterwards, with perfect goodwill and harmony. Seeing that Traddles now glanced anxiously at my aunt again, I reminded him of the second and last point to which he had adverted. "You and your aunt will excuse me, Copperfield, if I touch upon a painful theme, as I greatly fear I shall," said Traddles, hesitating, "but I think it necessary to bring it to your recollection. On the day of Mr. Micawber's memorable denunciation, a threatening allusion was made by Uriah Heep to your aunt's husband. My aunt, retaining her stiff position and apparent composure, assented with a nod. "Perhaps," observed Traddles, "it was mere purposeless impertinence." "No," returned my aunt. "There was, pardon me, really, such a person, and at all in his power?" hinted Traddles. "Yes, my good friend," said my aunt. Traddles, with a perceptible lengthening of his face, explained that he had not been able to approach this subject, that it had shared the fate of Mr. Micawber's liabilities in not being comprehended in the terms he'd made, that we were no longer of any authority with Uriah Heep, and that if he could do us or any of us any injury or annoyance, no doubt he would. My aunt remained quiet, until again some stray tears found their way to her cheeks. "You're quite right," she said. "It was very thoughtful to mention it. Can I, or Copperfield, do anything?" asked Traddles gently. "Nothing," said my aunt. "I thank you many times. Trot, my dear, a vain threat. Let us have Mr. and Mrs. Micawber back, and don't any of you speak to me." With that she smoothed her dress and sat with her upright carriage looking at the door. "Well, Mr. and Mrs. Micawber," said my aunt when they entered, "we have been discussing your emigration, with many apologies to you for keeping you out of the room so long, and I'll tell you what arrangements we propose." These, she explained, to the unbounded satisfaction of the family, children and all being then present, and so much to the awakening of Mr. Micawber's punctual habits in the opening stage of all bill transactions, that he could not be dissuaded from immediately rushing out in the highest spirits to buy the stamps for his notes of hand. But his joy received a sudden check, for within 5 minutes he returned in the custody of a sheriff's officer, informing us in a flood of tears that all was lost. We, being quite prepared for this event, which was, of course, a proceeding of Uriah Heep's, soon paid the money, and in 5 minutes more Mr. Micawber was seated at the table, filling up the stamps with an expression of perfect joy, which only that congenial employment, or the making of punch, could impart in full completeness to his shining face. To see him at work on the stamps, with the relish of an artist, touching them like pictures, looking at them sideways, taking weighty notes of dates and amounts in his pocket-book, and contemplating them when finished, with a high sense of their precious value, was a sight indeed. "Now, the best thing you can do, sir, if you'll allow me to advise you," said my aunt, after silently observing him, "is to abjure that occupation for evermore." "Madam," replied Mr. Micawber, "it is my intention to register such a vow on the virgin page of the future. Mrs. Micawber will attest it. I trust," said Mr. Micawber solemnly, "that my son Wilkins will ever bear in mind that he had infinitely better put his fist in the fire than use it to handle the serpents that have poisoned the life-blood of his unhappy parent." Deeply affected, and changed in a moment to the image of despair, Mr. Micawber regarded the serpents with a look of gloomy abhorrence, in which his late admiration of them was not quite subdued, folded them up, and put them in his pocket. This closed the proceedings of the evening. We were weary with sorrow and fatigue, and my aunt and I were to return to London on the morrow. It was arranged that the Micawbers should follow us after effecting a sale of their goods to a broker, that Mr. Wickfield's affairs should be brought to a settlement with all convenient speed under the direction of Traddles, and that Agnes should also come to London, pending those arrangements. We passed the night at the old house, which, freed from the presence of the Heaps, seemed purged of a disease, and I lay in my old room like a shipwrecked wanderer come home. We went back next day to my aunt's house, not to mine, and when she and I sat alone, as of old, before going to bed, she said, "Trot, do you really wish to know what I have had upon my mind lately?" "Indeed I do, aunt. If there ever was a time when I felt unwilling that you should have a sorrow or anxiety which I couldn't share, it's now." "You have had sorrow enough, child," said my aunt affectionately, "without the addition of my little miseries. I could have no other motive, Trot, in keeping anything from you." "I know that well," said I, "but tell me now. Would you ride with me a little way tomorrow morning?" asked my aunt. "Of course." "At 9, said she. "I'll tell you then, my dear." At 9, accordingly, we went out in a little chariot and drove to London. We drove a long way through the streets, until we came to one of the large hospitals. Standing hard by the building was a plain hearse. The driver recognised my aunt, and, in obedience to a motion of her hand at the window, drove slowly off, we following. "You understand it now, Trot," said my aunt. "He is gone." "Did he die in the hospital?" "Yes." She sat immovable beside me, but again I saw the stray tears on her face. "He was there once before," said my aunt presently. "He was ailing a long time. A shattered, broken man these many years. When he knew his state in this last illness, he asked them to send for me. He was sorry then. Very sorry." "You went, I know, aunt." "I went. I was with him a good deal afterwards." "He died the night before we went to Canterbury," said I. My aunt nodded. "No one can harm him now," she said. That was a vain threat. We drove away out of town to the churchyard at Hornsey. "Better here than in the streets," said my aunt. "He was born here." We alighted and followed the plain coffin to a corner I remember well, where the service was read consigning it to the dust. 36 years ago this day, my dear, said my aunt as we walked back to the chariot, I was married. God forgive us all. We took our seats in silence, and so she sat beside me for a long time, holding my hand. At length she suddenly burst into tears and said, He was a fine-looking man when I married him, Trot, and he was sadly changed. It didn't last long. After the relief of tears, she soon became composed and even cheerful. Her nerves were a little shaken, she said, or she would not have given way to it. God forgive us all. So we rode back to her little cottage at Highgate, where we found the following short note, which had arrived by that morning's post from Mr. Micawber. Canterbury, Friday. My dear Madam and Copperfield, the fair land of promise lately looming on the horizon is again enveloped in impenetrable mists, and for ever withdrawn from the eyes of a drifting wretch whose doom is sealed. Another writ has been issued in His Majesty's High Court of King's Bench at Westminster, in another cause of Heap versus Micawber, and the defendant in that cause is the prey of the sheriff having legal jurisdiction in this bailiwick. Now's the day and now's the hour, see the front of battle lower, see approach proud Edward's power, chains and slavery. Consigned to which, and to a speedy end, for mental torture is not supportable beyond a certain point, and that point I feel I have attained, my course is run. Bless you, some future traveller, visiting from motives of curiosity not unmingled, let us hope with sympathy, the place of confinement allotted to debtors in this city may, and I trust will, ponder as he traces on its wall, inscribed with a rusty nail, the obscure initials W.M. P.S. I reopen this to say that our common friend Mr. Thomas Traddles, who has not yet left us, and is looking extremely well, has paid the debt and costs in the noble name of Miss Trotwood, and that myself and family are at the height of earthly bliss. Chapter 55. Tempest. I now approach an event in my life so indelible, so awful, so bound by an infinite variety of ties to all that has preceded it in these pages, that from the beginning of my narrative I have seen it growing larger and larger as I advanced, like a great tower in a plain, and throwing its forecast shadow even on the incidents of my childish days. For years after it occurred, I dreamt of it often. I started up so vividly impressed by it that its fury has yet seemed raging in my quiet room in the still night. I dream of it sometimes, though at lengthened and uncertain intervals, to this hour. I have an association between it and a stormy wind, or the lightest mention of a seashore, as strong as any of which my mind is conscious. As plainly as I behold what happened, I will try to write it down. I do not recall it, but see it done, for it happens again before me. The time drawing on rapidly for the sailing of the emigrant ship, my good old nurse, almost broken-hearted for me when we first met, came up to London. I was constantly with her and her brother and the Micawbers, they being very much together, but Emily I never saw. One evening, when the time was close at hand, I was alone with Peggotty and her brother. Our conversation turned on Ham. She described to us how tenderly he had taken leave of her, and how manfully and quietly he had borne himself. Most of all, of late, when she believed he was most tried. It was a subject of which the affectionate creature never tired, and our interest in hearing the many examples which she, who was so much with him, had to relate, was equal to hers in relating them. My aunt and I were at that time vacating the two cottages at Highgate, I intending to go abroad, and she to return to her house at Dover. We had a temporary lodging in Covent Garden. As I walked home to it after this evening's conversation, reflecting on what had passed between Ham and myself when I was last in Yarmouth, I wavered in the original purpose I'd formed of leaving a letter for Emily when I should take leave of her uncle on board the ship, and thought it would be better to write to her now. She might desire, I thought, after receiving my communication, to send some parting word by me to her unhappy lover. I ought to give her the opportunity. I therefore sat down in my room before going to bed and wrote to her. I told her that I had seen him, and that he had requested me to tell her what I have already written in its place in these sheets. I faithfully repeated it. I had no need to enlarge upon it, if I'd had the right. Its deep fidelity and goodness were not to be adorned by me or any man. I left it out to be sent round in the morning with a line to Mr. Peggotty requesting him to give it to her, and went to bed at daybreak. I was weaker than I knew then, and not falling asleep until the sun was up, lay late and unrefreshed next day. I was roused by the silent presence of my aunt at my bedside. I felt it in my sleep, as I suppose we all do feel such things. "Trot, my dear," she said when I opened my eyes, "I couldn't make up my mind to disturb you. Mr. Peggotty is here. Shall he come up?" I replied yes, and he soon appeared. "Master Davy," he said, when we'd shaken hands, "I give Emily your letter, sir, and she writ this here, and begged of me for her to ask you to read it, and if you see no hurt in, to be so kind as to take charge on't." "Have you read it?" said I. He nodded sorrowfully. I opened it and read as follows. "I have got your message. Oh, what can I write to thank you for your good and blessed kindness to me? I have put the words close to my heart. I shall keep them till I die. They are sharp thorns, but they are such comfort. I have prayed over them. Oh, I have prayed so much. When I find what you are and what uncle is, I think what God must be, and can cry to him. Goodbye for ever. Now, my dear, my friend, goodbye for ever in this world. In another world, if I'm forgiven, I may wake a child and come to you. All thanks and blessings, farewell evermore. This, blotted with tears, was the letter." "May I tell her as you don't see no hurt in it, and as you'll be so kind as to take charge, aren't Master Davy?" said Mr. Peggotty, when I'd read it. "Unquestionably," said I. "But I'm thinking..." "Yes, Master Davy?" "I'm thinking," said I, "that I'll go down again to Yarmouth. There's time and to spare for me to go and come back before the ship sails. My mind is constantly running on him in his solitude. To put this letter of her writing in his hand at this time, and to enable you to tell her in the moment of parting that he's got it, will be a kindness to both of them. I solemnly accepted his commission, dear good fellow, and cannot discharge it too completely. The journey's nothing to me. I'm restless and shall be better in motion. I'll go down tonight." Though he anxiously endeavoured to dissuade me, I saw that he was of my mind, and this, if I had required to be confirmed in my intention, would have had the effect. He went round to the coach office at my request and took the box seat for me on the mail. In the evening I started by that conveyance down the road I had traversed under so many vicissitudes. "Don't you think that," I asked the coachman in the first stage out of London, "a very remarkable sky? I don't remember to have seen one like it."
"Nor I. Not equal to it," he replied. "That's wind, sir. There'll be mischief done at sea, I expect, before long."
It was a murky confusion, here and there blotted with a colour like the colour of the smoke from damp fuel, of flying clouds tossed up into most remarkable heaps, suggesting greater heights in the clouds than there were depths below them to the bottom of the deepest hollows in the earth, through which the wild moon seemed to plunge headlong, as if, in a dread disturbance of the laws of nature, she'd lost her way and were frightened. There'd been a wind all day, and it was rising then with an extraordinary great sound. In another hour it had much increased, and the sky was more overcast, and it blew hard. But as the night advanced, the clouds closing in and densely overspreading the whole sky, then very dark, it came on to blow harder and harder. It still increased until our horses could scarcely face the wind. Many times in the dark part of the night, it was then late in September when the nights were not short, the leaders turned about or came to a dead stop, and we were often in serious apprehension that the coach would be blown over. Sweeping gusts of rain came up before this storm, like showers of steel, and at those times when there was any shelter of trees or lee walls to be got, we were fain to stop in a sheer impossibility of continuing the struggle. When the day broke, it blew harder and harder. I had been in Yarmouth when the seamen said it blew great guns, but I had never known the like of this or anything approaching to it. We came to Ipswich very late, having had to fight every inch of ground since we were 10 miles out of London, and found a cluster of people in the marketplace who had risen from their beds in the night, fearful of falling chimneys. Some of these, congregating about the inn-yard while we changed horses, told us of great sheets of lead having been ripped off a high church tower and flung into a by-street, which they then blocked up. Others had to tell of country people coming in from neighbouring villages who'd seen great trees lying torn out of the earth and whole ricks scattered about the roads and fields. Still there was no abatement in the storm, but it blew harder. As we struggled on, nearer and nearer to the sea, from which this mighty wind was blowing dead on shore, its force became more and more terrific. Long before we saw the sea, its spray was on our lips, and showered salt rain upon us. The water was out over miles and miles of the flat country adjacent to Yarmouth, and every sheet and puddle lashed its banks, and had its stress of little breakers setting heavily towards us. When we came within sight of the sea, the waves on the horizon, caught at intervals above the rolling abyss, were like glimpses of another shore with towers and buildings. When at last we got into the town, the people came out to their doors all aslant and with streaming hair, making a wonder of the mail that had come through such a night. I put up at the old inn and went down to look at the sea. Staggering along the street, which was strewn with sand and seaweed and with flying blotches of sea foam, afraid of falling slates and tiles, and holding by people I met at angry corners. Coming near the beach, I saw not only the boatmen, but half the people of the town lurking behind buildings, some now and then braving the fury of the storm to look away to sea and blown sheer out of their course in trying to get zigzag back. Joining these groups, I found bewailing women whose husbands were away in herring or oyster boats, which there was too much reason to think might have foundered before they could run in anywhere for safety. Grizzled old sailors were among the people, shaking their heads as they looked from water to sky and muttering to one another. Shipowners excited and uneasy, children huddling together and peering into older faces, even stout mariners disturbed and anxious, levelling their glasses at the sea from behind places of shelter, as if they were surveying an enemy. The tremendous sea itself, when I could find sufficient pause to look at it, in the agitation of the blinding wind, the flying stones and sand, and the awful noise, confounded me. As the high, watery walls came rolling in, and at their highest tumbled into surf, they looked as if the least would engulf the town. As the receding wave swept back with a hoarse roar, it seemed to scoop out deep caves in the beach, as if its purpose were to undermine the earth. When some white-headed billows thundered on and dashed themselves to pieces before they reached the land, every fragment of the late whole seemed possessed by the full might of its wrath, rushing to be gathered to the composition of another monster. Undulating hills were changed to valleys. Undulating valleys, with a solitary storm-bird sometimes skimming through them, were lifted up to hills. Masses of water shivered and shook the beach with a booming sound. Every shape tumultuously rolled on as soon as made to change its shape and place, and beat another shape and place away. The ideal shore on the horizon, with its towers and buildings, rose and fell. The clouds flew fast and thick. I seemed to see a rending and upheaving of all nature. Not finding Ham among the people whom this memorable wind, for it still remembered down there as the greatest ever known to blow upon that coast, had brought together, I made my way to his house. It was shut, and no one answered to my knocking. I went by back ways and by lanes to the yard where he worked. I learned there that he'd gone to Lowestoft to meet some sudden exigency of ship repairing in which his skill was required, but that he would be back tomorrow morning in good time. I went back to the inn, and when I'd washed and dressed and tried to sleep, but in vain, it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I hadn't sat 5 minutes by the coffee-room fire when the waiter, coming to stir it, as an excuse for talking, told me that 2 colliers had gone down with all hands a few miles away, and that some other ships had been seen labouring hard in the roads and trying, in great distress, to keep offshore. "Mercy on them and all poor sailors," said he, "if we had another night like the last." I was very much depressed in spirits, very solitary, and felt an uneasiness in Ham's not being there, disproportionate to the occasion. I was seriously affected, without knowing how much, by late events, and my long exposure to the fierce wind had confused me. There was that jumble in my thoughts and recollections that I'd lost the clear arrangement of time and distance. Thus, if I had gone out into the town, I should not have been surprised, I think, to encounter someone who I knew must be then in London. So to speak, there was, in these respects, a curious inattention in my mind. Yet it was busy, too, with all the remembrances the place naturally awakened, and they were particularly distinct and vivid. In this state, the waiter's dismal intelligence about the ships immediately connected itself, without any effort of my volition, with my uneasiness about Ham. I was persuaded that I had an apprehension of his returning from Lowestoft by sea and being lost. This grew so strong with me that I resolved to go back to the yard before I took my dinner and ask the boatbuilder if he thought his attempting to return by sea at all likely. If he gave me the least reason to think so, I would go over to Lowestoft unprevented by bringing him with me. I hastily ordered my dinner and went back to the yard. I was none too soon, for the boatbuilder, with a lantern in his hand, was locking the yard gate. He quite laughed when I asked him the question, and said there was no fear no man in his senses or out of them would put off in such a gale of wind, least of all Ham Peggotty, who had been born to seafaring. So sensible of this beforehand, that I had really felt ashamed of doing what I was nevertheless impelled to do, I went back to the inn. If such a wind could rise, I think it was rising. The howl and roar, the rattling of the doors and windows, the rumbling in the chimneys, the apparent rocking of the very house that sheltered me, and the prodigious tumult of the sea were more fearful than in the morning. But there was now a great darkness besides, and that invested the storm with new terrors, real and fanciful. I could not eat, I could not sit still, I could not continue steadfast to anything. Something within me, faintly answering to the storm without, tossed up the depths of my memory and made a tumult in them. Yet in all the hurry of my thoughts, while running with the thundering sea, the storm and my uneasiness regarding Ham were always in the foreground. My dinner went away almost untasted, and I tried to refresh myself with a glass or two of wine. In vain. I fell into a dull slumber before the fire, without losing my consciousness either of the uproar out of doors or of the place in which I was. Both became overshadowed by a new and indefinable horror. And when I awoke, or rather when I shook off the lethargy that bound me in my chair, my whole frame thrilled with objectless and unintelligible fear. I walked to and fro, tried to read an old gazetteer, listened to the awful noises, looked looked at faces, scenes and figures in the fire. At length, the steady ticking of the undisturbed clock on the wall tormented me to that degree that I resolved to go to bed. It was reassuring on such a night to be told that some of the inn-servants had agreed together to sit up until morning. I went to bed exceedingly weary and heavy, but on my lying down all such sensations vanished as if by magic, and I was broad awake with every sense refined. For hours I lay there, listening to the wind and water, imagining, now that I heard shrieks out at sea, now that I distinctly heard the firing of signal guns, and now the fall of houses in the town. I got up several times and looked out, but could see nothing, except the reflection in the window panes of the faint candle I had left burning, and of my own haggard face looking in at me from the black void. At length, my restlessness attained to such a pitch that I hurried on my clothes and went downstairs. In the large kitchen, where I dimly saw bacon and ropes of onions hanging from the beams, the watchers were clustered together in various attitudes about a table, purposely moved away from the great chimney and brought near the door. A pretty girl, who had her ears stopped with her apron and her eyes upon the door, screamed when I appeared, supposing me to be a spirit. But the others had more presence of mind, and were glad of an addition to their company. One man, referring to the topic they had been discussing, asked me whether I thought the souls of the collier crews who had gone down were out in the storm. I remained there, I dare say, 2 hours. Once I opened the yard gate and looked into the empty street. The sand, the seaweed, and the flakes of foam were driving by, and I was obliged to call for assistance before I could shut the gate again and make it fast against the wind. There was a dark gloom in my solitary chamber when I at length returned to it, but I was tired now, and getting into bed again, fell off a tower and down a precipice into the depths of sleep. I have an impression that for a long time, though I dreamt of being elsewhere, and in a variety of scenes, it was always blowing in my dream. At length I lost that feeble hold upon reality, and was engaged with two dear friends, but who they were I don't know, at the siege of some town in a roar of cannonading. The thunder of the cannon was so loud and incessant that I couldn't hear something I much desired to hear until I made a great exertion and awoke. It was broad day, 8 or 9 o'clock, the storm raging in lieu of the batteries, and someone knocking and calling at my door. "What's the matter?" I cried. "A wreck! Close by!" I sprang out of bed and asked, "What wreck?" "A schooner from Spain or Portugal, laden with fruit and wine. Make haste, sir, if you want to see her. It's thought down on the beach you'll go to pieces every moment." The excited voice went clamouring along the staircase, and I wrapped myself in my clothes as quickly as I could and ran into the street. Numbers of people were there before me, all running in one direction, to the beach. I ran the same way, outstripping a good many, and soon came facing the wild sea. The wind might by this time have lulled a little, though not more sensibly than if the cannonading I dreamt of had been diminished by the silencing of half a dozen guns out of hundreds. But the sea, having upon it the additional agitation of the whole night, was infinitely more terrific than when I had seen it last. Every appearance it had then presented bore the expression of being swelled, and the height to which the breakers rose, and looking over one another, bore one another down and rolled in interminable hosts, was most appalling. In the difficulty of hearing anything but wind and waves, and in the crowd, in the unspeakable confusion, and my first breathless efforts to stand against the weather, I was so confused that I looked out to sea for the wreck and saw nothing but the foamy heads of the great waves. A half-dressed boatman standing next me pointed with his bare arm, a tattooed arrow on it pointing in the same direction, to the left. Then, oh, great heaven, I saw it, close in upon us. One mast was broken short off 6 or 8 feet from the deck, and lay over the side, entangled in a maze of sail and rigging, and all that ruin as the ship rolled and beat, which she did without a moment's pause and with a violence quite inconceivable, beat the side as if it would stave it in. Some efforts were even then being made to cut this portion of the wreck away, for as the ship, which was broadside on, turned towards us in her rolling, I plainly described her people at work with axes, especially one active young figure with long curling hair, conspicuous among the rest. But a great cry, which was audible even above the wind and water, rose from the shore at this moment. The sea, sweeping over the rolling wreck, made a clean breach, and carried men, spars, casks, planks, bulwarks, heaps of such toys, into the boiling surge. The second mast was yet standing, with the rags of a rent sail, and a wild confusion of broken cordage flapping to and fro. The ship had struck once, the same boatman hoarsely said in my ear, and then lifted in and struck again. I understood him to add that she was parting amidships, and I could readily suppose so, for the rolling and beating were too tremendous for any human work to suffer long. As he spoke, there was another great cry of pity from the beach. Four men arose with the wreck out of the deep, clinging to the rigging of the remaining mast. Uppermost, the active figure with the curling hair. There was a bell on board, and as the ship rolled and dashed like a desperate creature driven mad, now showing us the whole sweep of her deck, as she turned on her beam ends towards the shore, now nothing but her keel, as she sprung wildly over and turned towards the sea, the bell rang. And its sound, the knell of those unhappy men, was borne towards us on the wind. Again we lost her, and again she rose. Two men were gone. The agony on shore increased. Men groaned and clasped their hands. Women shrieked and turned away their faces. Some ran wildly up and down along the beach, crying for help where no help could be found. I found myself one of these, frantically imploring a knot of sailors whom I knew not to let those two lost creatures perish before our eyes. They were making out to me in an agitated way. I don't know how, for the little I could hear, I was scarcely composed enough to understand that the lifeboat had been bravely manned an hour ago and could do nothing, and that as no man would be so desperate as to attempt to wade off with a rope and establish a communication with the shore, there was nothing left to try, when I noticed that some new sensation moved the people on the beach and saw them part and ham come breaking through them to the front. I ran to him, as well as I know to repeat my appeal for help. But distracted though I was by a sight so new to me and terrible, the determination in his face and his look out to sea, exactly the same look as I remembered in connection with the morning after Emily's flight, awoke me to a knowledge of his danger. I held him back with both arms and implored the men with whom I'd been speaking not to listen to him, not to do murder, not to let him stir from off that sand. Another cry arose on shore, and looking to the wreck we saw the cruel sail, with blow on blow, beat off the lower of the two men and fly up in triumph round the active figure left alone upon the mast. Against such a sight, and against such determination as that of the calmly desperate man who was already accustomed to lead half the people present, I might as hopefully have entreated the wind. "Master Davy," he said cheerily, grasping me by both hands, "if my time is come, 'tis come. If tan't, I'll bide it, Lord above. Bless you and bless all mates. Make me ready. I'm a-going off." I was swept away, but not unkindly, to some distance, where the people around me made me stay. Urging, as I confusedly perceived, that he was bent on going with help or without, and that I should endanger the precautions for his safety by troubling those with whom they rested. I don't know what I answered or what they rejoined, but I saw hurry on the beach, and men running with ropes from a capstan that was there, and penetrating into a circle of figures that hid him from me. Then I saw him, standing alone, in a seaman's frock and trousers, a rope in his hand or slung to his wrist, another round his body, and several of the best men holding at a little distance to the latter, which he laid out himself slack upon the shore at his feet. The wreck, even to my unpracticed eye, was breaking up. I saw that she was parting in the middle, and that the life of the solitary man upon the mast now hung by a thread. Still he clung to it. He had a singular red cap on, not like a sailor's cap, but of a finer colour. And as the few yielding planks between him and destruction rolled and bulged, and his anticipative death knell rung, he was seen by all of us to wave it.
I saw him do it now, and thought I was going distracted, when his action brought an old remembrance to my mind of a once dear friend. Ham watched the sea, standing alone with the silence of suspended breath behind him, and the storm before, until there was a great retiring wave, when, with a backward glance at those who held the rope which was made fast round his body, he dashed in after it, and in a moment was buffeting with the water, rising with the hills, falling with the valleys, lost beneath the foam, then drawn again to land. They hauled in, hastily. He was hurt. I saw blood on his face from where I stood, but he took no thought of that. He seemed hurriedly to give them some directions for leaving him more free, or so I judged from the motion of his arm, and was gone as before. And now he made for the wreck, rising with the hills, falling with the valleys, lost beneath the rugged foam, borne in towards the shore, borne on towards the ship, striving hard and valiantly. The distance was nothing, but the power of the sea and wind made the strife deadly. At length he neared the wreck. He was so near that with one more of his vigorous strokes he would be clinging to it, when a high, green, vast hillside of water, moving on shoreward from beyond the ship, he seemed to leap up into it with a mighty bound, and the ship was gone. Some eddying fragments I saw in the sea, as if a mere cask had been broken, running to the spot where they were hauling in. Consternation was in every face. They drew him to my very feet, insensible, dead. He was carried to the nearest house, and no one preventing me now, I remained near him, busy, while every means of restoration were tried. But he had been beaten to death by the great wave, and his generous heart was stilled for ever. As I sat beside the bed when hope was abandoned and all was done, a fisherman, who had known me when Emily and I were children, and ever since, whispered my name at the door. "Sir," said he, with tears starting to his weather-beaten face, which, with his trembling lips, was ashy pale, "will you come over yonder?" The old remembrance that had been recalled to me was in his look. I asked him, terror-stricken, leaning on the arm he held out to support me, "Has a body come ashore?" He said, "Yes." "Do I know it?" I asked then. He answered nothing, but he led me to the shore. And on that part of it where she and I had looked for shells, two children, on that part of it where some lighter fragments of the old boat blown down last night had been scattered by the wind, among the ruins of the home he had wronged, I saw him lying with his head upon his arm, as I had often seen him lie at school.
This ends side one of cassette 25. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
Chapter 56. The New Wound and the Old. No need, O Steerforth, to send when we last spoke together
in that hour which I so little deemed to be our parting hour. No need to have said, "Think of me at my best." I'd done that ever. And could I change now, looking on this sight? They brought a hand bier and laid him on it, and covered him with a flag, and took him and bore him on towards the houses. All the men who carried him had known him, and gone sailing with him, and seen him merry and bold. They carried him through the wild roar, a hush in the midst of all the tumult, and took him to the cottage where death was already. But when they sat the bier down on the threshold, they looked at one another and at me, and whispered. I knew why. They felt as if it were not right to lay him down in the same quiet room. We went into the town and took our burden to the inn. So soon as I could at all collect my thoughts, I sent for Joram and begged him to provide me a conveyance in which it could be got to London in the night. I knew that the care of it and the hard duty of preparing his mother to receive it could only rest with me, and I was anxious to discharge that duty as faithfully as I could. I chose the night for the journey, that there might be less curiosity when I left the town. But although it was nearly midnight when I came out of the yard in a chaise, followed by what I had in charge, there were many people waiting, at intervals along the town, and even a little way out upon the road I saw more. But at length only the bleak night and the open country were around me, and the ashes of my youthful friendship. Upon a mellow autumn day about noon, when the ground was perfumed by fallen leaves, and many more in beautiful tints of yellow, red, and brown, yet hung upon the trees through which the sun was shining, I arrived at Highgate. I walked the last mile, thinking as I went along of what I had to do, and left the carriage that had followed me all through the night awaiting orders to advance. The house, when I came up to it, looked just the same. Not a blind was raised. No sign of life was in the dull paved court with its covered way leading to the disused door. The wind had quite gone down and nothing moved. I had not at first the courage to ring at the gate, and when I did ring, my errand seemed to me to be expressed in the very sound of the bell. The little parlour-maid came out with a key in her hand, and looking earnestly at me as she unlocked the gate, said, "I beg your pardon, sir, are you ill?" "I've been much agitated and am fatigued."
"Is anything the matter, sir?" "Mr. James?"
"Shh," said I, "yes. Something has happened that I have to break to Mrs. Steerforth." "She's at home?" The girl anxiously replied that her mistress was very seldom out now, even in a carriage, that she kept her room, that she saw no company, but would see me. Her mistress was up, she said, and Miss Dartle was with her. What message should she take upstairs? Giving her a strict charge to be careful of her manner, and only to carry in my card and say I waited, I sat down in the drawing-room, which we had now reached, until she should come back. Its former pleasant air of occupation was gone, and the shutters were half closed. The harp hadn't been used for many and many a day. His picture, as a boy, was there. The cabinet in which his mother had kept his letters was there. I wondered if she ever read them now, if she would ever read them more. The house was so still that I heard the girl's light step upstairs. On her return, she brought a message to the effect that Mrs. Steerforth was an invalid and couldn't come down, but that if I would excuse her being in her chamber, she would be glad to see me. In a few moments, I stood before her. She was in his room, not in her own. I felt, of course, that she'd taken to occupy it in remembrance of him, and that the many tokens of his old sports and accomplishments by which she was surrounded remained there just as he'd left them for the same reason. She murmured, however, even in her reception of me, that she was out of her own chamber because its aspect was unsuited to her infirmity, and with her stately look repelled the least suspicion of the truth. At her chair, as usual, was Rosa Dartle. From the first moment of her dark eyes resting on me, I saw she knew I was the bearer of evil tidings. The scar sprung into view that instant. She withdrew herself a step behind the chair to keep her own face out of Mrs. Steerforth's observation, and scrutinized me with a piercing gaze that never faltered, never shrunk. "I am sorry to observe you are in mourning, sir," said Mrs. Steerforth.
I am unhappily a widower, said I.
You're very young to know so great a loss, she returned. I'm grieved to hear it. I'm grieved to hear it. I hope time will be good to you.
I hope time, said I, looking at her, will be good to all of us.
Dear Mrs. Steerforth, we must all trust to that, in our heaviest misfortunes. The earnestness of my manner and the tears in my eyes alarmed her. The whole course of her thoughts appeared to stop and change. I tried to command my voice in gently saying his name, but it trembled. She repeated it to herself two or three times in a low tone. Then, addressing me, she said with enforced calmness, "My son is ill. Very ill. You've seen him?"
"I have."
"Are you reconciled?"
I couldn't say yes, I couldn't say no.
She slightly turned her head towards the spot where Rosa Dartle had been standing at her elbow. And in that moment I said by the motion of my lips to Rosa, "Dead." That Mrs. Steerforth might not be induced to look behind her and read plainly written what she was not yet prepared to know, I met her look quickly. But I'd seen Rosa Dartle throw her hands up in the air with vehemence of despair and horror, and then clasp them on her face. The handsome lady, so like, oh, so like, regarded me with a fixed look and put a hand to her forehead. I besought her to be calm and prepare herself to bear what I had to tell. But I should rather have entreated her to weep, for she sat like a stone figure. "When I was last here," I faltered, "Miss Dartle told me he was sailing here and there." "The night before last was a dreadful one at sea. If he were at sea that night and near a dangerous coast, as it said he was, and if the vessel that was seen should really be the ship which—" "Rosa," said Mrs. Steerforth, "come to me." She came, but with no sympathy or gentleness. Her eyes gleamed like fire as she confronted his mother and broke into a frightful laugh. "Now," she said, "is your pride appeased, you mad woman? Now has he made atonement to you with his life? Do you hear? His life!" Mrs. Steerforth, fallen back stiffly in her chair and making no sound but a moan, cast her eyes upon her with a wide stare. "I," cried Rosa, smiting herself passionately on the breast, "look at me! Moan and groan and look at me! Look here!" striking the scar. "That's your dead child's handiwork!" The moan the mother uttered from time to time went to my heart. Always the same, always inarticulate and stifled, always accompanied with an incapable motion of the head, but with no change of face. Always proceeding from a rigid mouth and closed teeth, as if the jaw were locked and the face frozen up in pain. "Do you remember when he did this?" she proceeded. "Do you remember when, in his inheritance of your nature and in your pampering of his pride and passion, he did this and disfigured me for life? Look at me, marked until I die with his high displeasure, and moan and groan for what you made him. Miss Darkle!" I entreated her. "For heaven's sake, I will speak," she said, turning on me with her lightning eyes. "Be silent, you! Look at me, I say, proud mother of a proud false son. Moan for your nature of him. Moan for your corruption of him. Moan for your loss of him. Moan for mine." She clenched her hand and trembled through her spare, worn figure, as if her passion were killing her by inches. "You resent his self-will!" she exclaimed. "You, injured by his haughty temper! You, who opposed to both when your hair was grey the qualities which made both when you gave him birth! You, who from his cradle reared him to be what he was and stunted what he should have been! Are you rewarded now for your years of trouble? Oh, Miss Darkle, shame! Oh, cruel!"
I tell you she'll return. I will speak to her. No power on earth should stop me while I was standing here. Have I been silent all these years, and shall I not speak now? I loved him better than you ever loved him.
Turning on her fiercely,
I could have loved him and asked no return. If I'd been his wife, I could have been the slave of his caprices for a word of love a year. I should have been. Who knows it better than I? You were exacting, proud, punctilious, selfish. My love would have been devoted, would have trod your paltry whimpering underfoot. With flashing eyes, she stamped upon the ground as if she actually did it. Look here, she said, striking the scar again with a relentless hand. When he grew into the better understanding of what he'd done, he saw it and repented of it. I could sing to him and talk to him and show the ardour that I felt in all he did, and attain with labour to such knowledge as most interested him, and I attracted him. When he was freshest and truest, he loved me. Yes, he did. Many a time, when you were put off with a slight word, he's taken me to his heart. She said it with a taunting pride in the midst of her frenzy, for it was little less, yet with an eager remembrance of it, in which the smouldering embers of a gentler feeling kindled for the moment. I descended, as I might have known I should, but that he fascinated me with his boyish courtship, into a doll. A trifle for the occupation of an idle hour, to be dropped and taken up and trifled with as the inconstant humour took him. When he grew weary, I grew weary. As his fancy died out, I would no more have tried to strengthen any power I had than I would have married him on his being forced to take me for his wife. We fell away from one another without a word. Perhaps you saw it and weren't sorry. Since then, I have been a mere disfigured piece of furniture between you both, having no eyes, no ears, no feelings, no remembrances. Moan? Moan for what you made him, not for your love. I tell you that the time was when I loved him better than you ever did. She stood with her bright, angry eyes confronting the wide stare and the set face, and softened no more when the moaning was repeated than if the face had been a picture. "Miss Darkle," said I, "if you can be so obdurate as not to feel for this afflicted mother..." "Who feels for me?" she sharply retorted. "She has sown this. Let her moan for the harvest that she reaps today." "And if his faults," I began. "Faults!" she cried, bursting into passionate tears. "Who dares malign him? He had a soul worth millions of the friends to whom he stooped. No one can have loved him better. No one can hold him in dearer remembrance than I replied. "I meant to say, if you have no compassion for his mother, or if his faults, you've been bitter on them..." "It's false!" she cried, tearing her black hair. "I loved him." "Cannot," I went on, "be banished from your remembrance in such an hour. Look at that figure even as one you have never seen before, and render it some help." All this time the figure was unchanged and looked unchangeable. Motionless, rigid, staring, moaning in the same dumb way from time to time, with the same helpless motion of the head, but giving no other sign of life. Miss Darkle suddenly knelt down before it and began to loosen the dress. "A curse upon you," she said, looking round at me with a mingled expression of rage and grief. "It was an evil hour that you ever came here. A curse upon you. Go!" After passing out of the room, I hurried back to ring the bell, the sooner to alarm the servants. She had then taken the impassive figure in her arms, and still, upon her knees, was weeping over it, kissing it, calling to it, rocking it to and fro upon her bosom like a child, and trying every tender means to rouse the dormant senses. No longer afraid of leaving her, I noiselessly turned back again and alarmed the house as I went out. Later in the day I returned, and we laid him in his mother's room. She was just the same, they told me. Miss Darkle never left her. Doctors were in attendance. Many things had been tried. But she lay like a statue, except
for the low sound now and then. I went through the dreary house and darkened the windows. The windows of the chamber where he lay I darkened last. I lifted up the leaden hand and held it to my heart. And all the world seemed death and silence.